which quite literally undermines Biden's diplomacy, gains the United States nothing, as Biden officials such as U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken have argued. But they have allowed it to block a restoration of the agreement regardless.
The recently passed resolution of the Board of Governors is non-binding. Though we enjoyed years of cooperation with the IAEA, we were not surprised by the resolution. The reason is that the IAEA has distanced itself from the technical and professional approach that it's supposed to have. The approach of the IAEA is now more political than technical.
The end result has been predictable. Iran is on the verge of becoming a nuclear threshold power. In the absence of a restored nuclear agreement, Iran has now produced a significant quantity of uranium enriched to the 60% threshold. If Iran decides to enrich that stockpile further, it is a stone's throw away from achieving 90% enrichment capability. Ordinary Iranians have suffered for 17 additional months under the maximum pressure sanctions Biden once condemned. Congressional allies have been left wondering why Biden is taking so long to act.
My point is that 2 years ago, the U.S. did not succeed to pass its proposed anti-Iran resolution in the U.N. Security Council. At that time, only the Dominican Republic voted in favor of the resolution. 9 member states abstained, China and Russia opposed, and the U.S. was isolated after failing in 2 attempts. Now that situation has changed, and we see that 30 countries vote against Iran in the Board of Governors. So I believe that it is in Iran's favor to continue its cooperation and negotiations with the IAEA to resolve this problem in a diplomatic way. Otherwise, more countries will join the United States in its anti-Iran measures, and this will not be in our favor.
Of course, we can continue negotiations, but we should not give priority to the JCPOA. We should focus on neutralizing sanctions in 2 fronts. Inside our country, we have to boost our economy and rely on our economy. In the international arena, we need to join international coalitions and join hands with Eurasian powers such as Russia and China to control sanctions. We can also join the trans-regional organizations like BRICS. Iran's foreign minister has recently sent a letter asking for Iran's membership in BRICS.
Unfortunately, without restoring the nuclear accord, there are no good options on Iran for Biden. Calls from hawks to impose more sanctions would do nothing to slow Iran's nuclear advances and would likely prompt more Iranian escalation. Biden would be wise to avoid such decisions at all costs. Plenty more coming up, but only after a quick diversion into world media. In the media section today, plenty of for and against to do with Iran's nuclear program and the resolution. Meh News reads, the head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Eslami, said in an interview with international media that the IAEA needs to put a stop to infiltration by Iran's enemies in its operations. Iran's nuclear chief added that the agency's focus on this country was discriminatory, as Iran accounted for only a small amount of global nuclear activity, but had to undergo what he said was over a quarter of all agency monitoring activity. This is when probes are based on fake documents and accounts provided by Iran's enemies led by the Zionist regime, and when Iran has offered its voluntary cooperation. Criticizing the trip by the IAEA's Director General Grossi to Israel, Eslami responded to Zionist Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, who had said that Israel reserved the right for self-defense should the IAEA's diplomacy with Iran fail. This is the culture that's dominant now, and these interferences have shown a clear movement against the Islamic Republic of Iran, said the Iranian Atomic Energy Agency chief. Now for for and against from friends and foes. But bearing in mind that Iran did comply with the JCPOA terms until it found itself unsupported by the West. Hence all the trouble that ensued. Saudi Arabia, Iran's regional rival, welcomes IAEA's resolution on Iran, according to Arab News. Saudi Arabia called on this country to cooperate with the IAEA and resolve outstanding issues without delay, stressing that Iran must comply with its obligations under the Safeguards Agreement, given the necessity to cooperate with the agency to resolve all outstanding nuclear issues. The IAEA said Wednesday it had adopted a resolution formally criticizing Iran for a lack of cooperation with the UN Nuclear Inspectorate, diplomatic sources told AFP. But this motion is the first to criticize Iran since June 2020 and comes amidst an impasse on efforts to bring the U.S. back into the 2015 deal over Iran's nuclear program. As for what Russia has to say, Mir News reads, Russia envoy ridicules anti-Iran's stupid resolution at IAEA, end quotes. Russia's envoy to international organizations based in Vienna has once again criticized the passing of an anti-Iran resolution. Russia's permanent representative being Mikhail Ulyanov, he wrote in a tweet that, have you got the latest news from hashtag Iran? Do you understand now why Russia voted against the stupid Western resolution of the hashtag IAEA Board of Governors on Iran yesterday? Regrettably, our Western counterparts demonstrate a total lack of understanding of where we are. Russia and China voted against the Western-drafted anti-Tehran resolution at the IAEA's Board of Governors Wednesday. That would be it for the news section. Do stay tuned. Question is, how many inspections is the agency doing in that country, the Zionist entity that is it even allowed to have an inspection there? Israel, which hates the JCPOA and is the only possessor of nuclear weapons in the region. Do comment on Grossi's trip to Israel. Isn't it a little bit weird? I mean, if we're talking nuclear justice here, Israel has up to 400 nuclear warheads in this region.
Israel, that possesses numerous nuclear warheads, hosted Mr. Grossi. This was a politically motivated move to put pressure on Iran. It is very clear that this visit was directly related to Iran's nuclear case, and it is sad to say that, like always, Israel is playing a role in the decision of the IAEA Board of Governors against Iran.
Grossi's visit to Tel Aviv at this delicate time when all parties are trying to revive the JCPOA has created critical responses among many political experts.
So what happened? How come the Israelis are happy? Basically, we believe that the IAEA is unfortunately spying for the US and Israel. However, some of the member countries have acted in a positive and brave way. What I mean is the current policy of the IAEA and the Director General. The decisions made in the agency and the acts are all in favor of the US and its allies and their mischievous plans against Iran.
The fact that there has never been an inspection of the Israeli nuclear facilities by the IAEA is common knowledge among international experts. In fact, there has never been one single clear and transparent statistic of the Israeli nuclear arsenal. Yet, the Zionist regime allows itself to accuse Iran of misleading the world with lies and false information. Washington has acknowledged for months that there will come a point when the deal's non-proliferation benefits become moot because Tehran is gaining irreversible nuclear knowledge and fast approaching nuclear threshold status. But for now, the push to revive the 2015 nuclear deal seems to have stalled over the U.S. designation of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, IRGC, as a foreign terrorist organization. With Washington reluctant to meet Tehran's demand of removing the group from the blacklist to seal the deal. In this regard, a source close to the Islamic Republic's diplomatic apparatus said if E3 stopped acting as accessories to the U.S. and the Zionist regime at the negotiating table and also quit their futile blame game and instead genuinely focused on resolving the issues, a revival of the nuclear deal is actually possible. But the diplomat underlined the fact that Britain, France and Germany have rather failed to even fulfill their own JCPOA commitments due to total impotence in resisting the US bullying behind the facade and seem to be absolutely powerless against the US coercion.
We have seen that the three European countries that were supposed to convince the United States to lift its sanctions on Iran sponsored an anti-Iran resolution at the IAEA Board of Governors. On the other hand, Mr. Grossi, who is expected to block unpeaceful nuclear activities, pays a visit to Israel. Israel has never joined the NPT and possesses nuclear warheads.
That'll be it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do return to the box at the same times next week and each week off. Bye for now.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint.
A critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. A warm welcome to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio. We try to criticize the movie Hotel Mumbai in the last two episodes, but we haven't come to an end of the critique of the movie Hotel Mumbai, produced in 2018, directed by Anthony Maras. And inshallah, we try to do that with my two guest speakers, Brother Hussein and Sayyid Abdullah. Brother Hussein, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum assalam, glad to be here.
You're welcome. And Sayyid Abdullah, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the studio.
Wa alaikum assalam, and thank you for having me.
You're welcome. We all know that this movie is based on some kind of true event which happened in 2008. Of course, the movie is produced 10 years after the true event, which happened on the 26th of November. Before we continue our critique of this movie, let's take a listen to a short part of this movie and then we'll be back. Don't go away.
Many of you have wives, parents, families at home. There is no shame in leaving.
I've been here 35 years. This is my home.
I'm staying too.
I'm with you, sir. I'm with you, sir.
Me too.
Guest is God, sir.
Follow me.
Here. Wrap that around your head. So I know you are one of them.
I'm not one of them.
Sir, madam, I just spoke to my boss. He says we should come upstairs to the Chambers Club. We'll be safer there. Why? You know something? How many there are where they are? I'm not sure, sir, but Chambers is the most secure place in the hotel. The Chambers is. Is the passage clear? Yes, sir. We'll go via the service desk. We'll leave in a couple of minutes, okay?
Back to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jad, hosting this program, and my two guest speakers, Brother Hussein and Sayyid Abdullah. Well, according to this part, Sayyid Abdullah, the chef, when the terrorist act happens in the hotel or within the hotel, the chef tries to take the initiative to gather and unite all the workers, all right, to help others, like the hotel guests and patrons, all right? Yeah. Why are some or few people basically, morally speaking, and let's say strong enough in character, all right, psychologically speaking, yeah, maybe, regardless of the religion, as you can see, India is very famous for it. We have lots of religions in India. Everybody worships a god there, all right? Well, and regardless of the religion, ideology, and so on and so forth, but you can see that kind of a strong and moral characteristic or trait in everyone, all right? We see it in great and ethical people, of course.
Yeah.
Right? Like Imam Hussein, for example, alayhi salam, or peace be upon him, to even relieve the soldiers by his talk, like the on the eve or the night of the Tasua and Ashura. He tries to like tell them that there is no fault if you take a flight today or tonight, all right? So why do we see this in great people but not in everyone?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. A leadership itself is a skill not everyone has. So we have that saying that says not everyone is born a leader. But there are people who are born leaders.
Exactly.
Right? So it depends on the upbringing in their own homes. If the parents themselves give the child enough character and enough confidence in himself, and they built him up from when he's young to take control of himself first and of things, he will develop that skill of being a leader. Sadly, a lot of people don't work on that in their kids. So they end up just being a normal, average,
ordinary Johnny people.
And Smith, ordinary people. But some of them, that because that's developed into them, so they even they themselves in matters of life, they always want to be dominant. They always want to be leaders. They always want to lead. And even when they choose their job, they choose jobs where they are in position.
But not every leader is brave.
Well,
brave
bravery is a different issue. It's a different characteristic. You know, it's a different trait altogether. So sometimes, so these people, like especially like in the movie with the chef, he himself, he's a chef. So he has that power and he has people under him. And he knows how to control them. So now there's an event that presented itself that required a leader. It was like, okay, I got the mind. I got the skills. Now it's time for me to stand up. So some people, they have that into them. And like I said, they seek these kind of positions. And when you deal with people once or twice and you become responsible for them, then it becomes one of these traits that it you know, it kind of lives with you. I give you an example for myself. I was at a certain time, I was a man manager of a company, right? So I had a lot of people working under me, and I bring them and I bring my stuff and I speak to them, I give them a pep talk, I tell them what's going on, stuff like that, and you know, I give them orders, I show them around. So when I walk around and event presents itself, if I don't see anyone taking control of the situation, I jump in because it's kind of embedded into me that someone has to lead, you know what I mean?
Natural
mankind, our nature, that we need someone to lead us. Right? So if this kind of skill has been developed into you, you will jump in. So this chef in here, in this particular case, the workers, I mean, even in terms of rank, they are lower than him. He's a chef. He's higher than everyone else. The guests, they have no idea what to do. So he kind of trooped his own staff. He was like, okay, this is what we need to do. And they marched the task. So he had that skill of leadership.
I see. Have you ever been to that kind of situation, like terrorist thing, like going around?
I have been in situations, but not as extreme. Like we've been into places where things has gone wrong and we need to take charge and need to march people, put people into positions and stuff like that. So whether it's in a workplace, whether it's in a camp, whether it's outside, I have been in such situations. But I mean, not extreme as, you know, being in a gunfight and in battle. But yeah. So, and people, like I said, sometimes they themselves, they need that leadership themselves because, like I said, it's they feel like lost. But once they see someone is in charge, people themselves, they come in and they start to help as well. Like they start to form a group.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break by listening to a part of the movie Hotel Mumbai, produced in 2018. In this program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio, and we'll be back. Don't go away.
Miss Kashani, please stop it.
Please come and sit
there,
please.
I have to be with my family. Open the door.
I know it's hard, but police are very near now.
No one's coming. We've been here 6 hours. 6 hours for what? No one's coming for us. My baby's out there. Please open the door.
She's right. Open the door.
I want to go.
Me too.
Please, please, we cannot evacuate everyone without being detected.
It's not everyone. No.
Six people.
That's all. We're going. Open the door.
Sir, if they hear us going, we will all die.
They know we are here. If they come back, we all die. If they bought the building, we die. If we leave, maybe we die. We take our chances.
These images taken around 4 a.m. show the moment security forces and angry citizens confronted the two gunmen, beating them with sticks. The gunman had earlier hijacked a police van and are thought to have been behind the CST station attack. Both men suffered multiple bullet wounds, from which one died, while the other, Admiral Kassab, is now in custody.
Back to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio. With me, Mohammad Jawad, hosting this program, and my two guest speakers, Brother Hussein and Sayyid Abdullah. There is the news person reporting about, you know, one of the terrorists being captured and interrogated by the police in that scene. And he answers that their mentor or the mastermind behind the attack told them that you are Muslims and infidels defraud you. Defrauds the Muslims and Middle East and the Eastern people. And they are the ones that left you in poverty. They left you behind and they went ahead. These are exact quotes from the guy. All right?
Yeah.
So they're talking about basically jihad. My first question is that what is jihad? And then even if it's true, is it a good excuse to take it out on the Westerners and revenge them this way through terrorism? Sayyid Abdullah?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First, let me try to answer that from an Islamic perspective.
Mm-hmm.
The word jihad in Arabic is taken or derived from the root word juhd, which means to persevere and put an effort. Okay?
Yes.
So anything that requires effort or that requires perseverance,
mm-hmm.
we call it jihad or juhd. So we consider a person who works for his family, he's a mujahid.
Yes.
A person who tries to achieve something, we call him mujahid.
Mm-hmm.
A mujtahid, which is an Islamic scholar, we give him that name because he puts an extra effort in trying to extract the laws from the Quran and the Hadith. So the word itself, it does not mean holy war.
Mm-hmm.
It does not mean to kill the infidels.
Yes.
Rather, this is one of the words in Arabic that I consider to be hijacked. It's a hijacked word.
Mm-hmm.
They took it, they gave it a meaning, and people believed it. It never meant a holy war. Jihad is from putting jihad. Now, if I go to war, it's a form of jihad because I have to go fight, I have to carry weapons, I have to do a lot of things.
Exactly.
So there's juhd involved. There is struggle. There is a perseverance. There is a work being in the process.
And not to mention, we have a hadith, if I'm not mistaken, that the greater jihad is something else against yourself, your nafs.
Exactly. When they came back, I said, you finished the minor jihad, now is the major jihad.
Yes.
Major jihad means that you go to struggle with yourself. You're trying to prevent yourself from committing sins and fighting your desires. So anything that's struggle in English, we refer to it as jihad, which is taken from the word juhd, which is to put effort into something else.
Mm-hmm.
So that term has been hijacked and it's been labeled as an Islamic term that means holy war. So nowhere in the Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, you know, there is something called jihad. He says jahidu. Jahidu means like put an effort to do something.
Yes.
Right? So this is in terms of when we talk about jihad Islamically. When it comes to the Western media or the Westerners, they have taken that kind of concept and they tried to apply it to anything that happens. Say, okay, this is an Islamic jihad. All right? I mean, Islam itself condones any form of killing. And Islam also condones any form of jihad, if we want to use that term as well, if it is, as we call, ibtida'i, if you are initiating.
Mm-hmm.
In Islam, it's haram to initiate any form of jihad.
Exactly.
The only time that you're
we
allowed
to never had
fight,
any kind of war never, in the Prophet time. Right?
Never. You never initiate any form of jihad unless you have to defend yourself. So defending yourself requires a form of perseverance or juhd or jihad.
Yes.
But do I have the right to go kill innocent people or kill infidels? Of course not. Never said in the Quran, never said in the Hadith. Actually, the Quran and the Hadith are against it. If you say you kill one person as if you killed the humanity, that's what the Quran says. So under what circumstances do you give yourself the right to go kill infidels? Islam condones it. Where did you bring that concept from?
Yes.
But like I said, the West, they found that as a camel or as a mule mm-hmm. to attack Islam with.
Yes. So no Muslims Islam. Shout, let's go jihading no? or jihadiering on the Westerners, for example.
No, no
or the infidels. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Hussein, for your being here with us in the studio of RIB English Radio. And for this program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program, we try to criticize the movie Hotel Mumbai, but we haven't finished it, and inshallah we'll resume criticizing this movie in the upcoming episode. Thank you very much for listening. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
There's been a big shooting at the CST station.
Madam, you're very safe here.
Security, can we get security now?
Lift them in!
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Seven, very much pressure.
We come to you, and oh God, knowing that thou art our only King.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillahi ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajahum. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. Islam as a religion has a particular foundation, has principles, and it is those principles that make Islam such a beautiful, such a pristine, such an inviting religion. It is religion, as we all know, is the fastest growing religion. Unfortunately, because of the efforts of the enemies, the speed of growth has slowed down, but it does not mean that it's still not growing. There are people all across the world who somehow, by the grace of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, are becoming aware of this pristine and pure message and coming into the fold of Islam. So the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners today is a book that tries to clarify and make clear what Islam actually is and the primary sources of Islamic thought. What do they say? That the Holy Quran and Ahadith of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam and the infallible and immaculate Imams from his progeny, what do they say? Not what other people have said about Islam. What does Islam say about particular issues? You know, what is the core and the fundamentals and the principles that Islam aims to show to a particular individual and towards its followers? So inshallah, this is a the, The book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners is on this particular topic. So please stay tuned.
Why do we read books in the first place? What are books good for?
We read books because we don't want to reinvent the wheel, if you will.
We'd better take advantage of human cultural and intellectual heritage, particularly related to our daily activities, such as our physical, mental, spiritual, or even religious health.
We can't ignore the past thoughts and experiences. To do so, we need to boost our bookshelf.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. So the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners is titled The Core of Islam. So this work, The Core of Islam, again, was recorded and edited by Brother Ammar Hegedus. My apologies if I pronounce it incorrectly. So it is, he mentions in the editor's note that this singular introduction to Islam in the English language presents in one easily accessible volume a coherent overview of the structures and practices of the faith of Islam. Informed by a profound level of Islamic scholarship, it answers many commonly asked questions of this much maligned faith. It is the fruit of incessant questions, why, that the almost unbelievably patient, kind, generous, and knowledgeable Ayatollah Milani was prepared to give of his time to answer. So we can see this was based on a session of questions and answers to the Sayyid, which were then recorded, edited, and put in a book form. A quest to acquire knowledge of the faith, like any journey of discovery, is fraught with sometimes seemingly unsurpassable difficulty. Those who have not studied Islam and Islamic history in some depth find many mundane and profound issues difficult to access. For example, what was the cultural context in which Islam developed? What are the faith's core beliefs? What is sacred to Muslims? What social behavior does Islam teach? What is the position of women in Islam? What are its main groupings? And most importantly, how can one best worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Allah willing, this according to the editor, later volumes will provide greater detail on both scholarly and spiritual aspects of the faith. So this is basically what this book is entailed. And hopefully, inshallah, in our next segment, we'll be reading a portion from the book for the benefit of our dear listeners. So please stay tuned.
Among the sacred texts we have received to help us understand where we came from and where we are going as a human race are most rich in helping us find our direction. They narrate stories of our past. But where have they brought us? Where are their messages now? Are we the people of belief, or have we become the people of the boxes? Is there wisdom trapped in our bookshelves? Bookshelves, bookshelves, bookshelves.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. The book that we have introduced to our dear listeners is titled The Core of Islam by Ayatollah Sayyid Fadhil Husseini Milani, recorded and edited by Brother Ammar Hegedus. So one of these sections is titled Principles of Faith. It is within the section of the main groupings of Islam and on page 85 of this book. So the Sayyid obviously was asked this question about what are the main groupings of Islam maybe. And this is his answer. So it says principles of faith. From the earliest days of Islam, scholars debated a variety of issues that today form the basis of what we refer to as Islamic theology. Namely, are divine attributes part of the essence or separate from it? Is the Holy Quran eternal or created? Do people have free will or are all things preordained? Is a sinner to be regarded as an unbeliever? Plus a variety of other equally arcane subjects. The first disagreement that was made public arose between the Asharites and the Mu'tazilites. Now, these are both groupings of Islamic theology, which came about in the second century of Hijri, who had established their own Sunni school of theology, which is known as Kalam. While the former group were known for uncompromising adherence to tradition, that is the Asharites, the latter were known as defenders of the intellect. Throughout history, various caliphs adopted contradictory stances, that e.g., for example, the Abbasid Caliph Al-Mu'min, 1198-218 AH, when he lived and died, supported Mu'tazila doctrine, while the Caliph Al-Mutawakkil, from 232-247 AH, sorry, that's not the date that they died, it is the date of the Khilafah, endorsed and supported the Asharite doctrine. Qadi Abu Bakr Baqilani, who died in the year 403 AH, the most influential scholar of his time to spread Ashari doctrine, spared no effort in his attempt to establish this belief as the sole presentation of Sunni faith. He resolutely attacked the Mu'tazilites to the extent that few were emboldened to adopt that madhab. And anyway, he goes on and he explains the history of the theology and the debates between the Ash'aris and the Mu'tazilites. So this is one of the few and topics that is discussed in this book. It deals with kalam, it deals with sociology, it deals with jurisprudence, it deals with all sorts of acts of worship and so on and so forth, that are the core, that are the principles, that are the foundations of the Islamic faith. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to firstly understand these foundations, these fundamentals, these core, and then also to practice upon it, and then obviously, hopefully, inshallah, to show others that this religion that we follow is not something that what is shown in the media, but rather it has a pure, pristine, and an immaculate foundation. Inshallah, until next time, my dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf with Brother Yasser Ibrahim on RIB English Radio.
In the limelight. In Georgia, United States, Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger is fending off a challenger fueled by Donald Trump's election lies. But do American voters still care about the 2020 as much as the former president does? The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Maya King. The piece is titled, In Georgia, a GOP primary tests the power of a Trump vendetta. An anti-Trump Republican advocacy group recently organized a focus group of GOP voters in Georgia to get their take on perhaps the most competitive and consequential primary election in the state. They heard a lot of indecision. Most of the voters convened by the group, the Republican Accountability Project, knew little about the race between Brad Raffensperger, Georgia's Secretary of State, and his leading challenger, Representative Jody Heiss. Mr. Raffensperger seemed to get the benefit of the doubt until the voters were reminded of the backstory. As the state official responsible for certifying the 2020 presidential election results, Mr. Raffensperger rejected President Donald Trump's attempt to overturn his defeat. Trump then recruited Jody Heiss to seek revenge. Go Jody, I guess, said one voter in Georgia. Three out of six others agreed. The exchange offered a glimpse into why the Republican primary race for the office that oversees elections remains a dogfight just days from the election day on 24th of May. 2 years after Donald Trump lost Georgia by the slimmest of margins and Democrats captured both of the state's open Senate seats, wounds from the 2020 presidential election have still not completely healed for some partisans. But marshalling the residual anger to unseat an incumbent is not an easy feat. Brad Raffensperger has worked to win back Republicans by casting himself as a defender of election integrity, even as he has spent hours debunking a laundry list of false claims about the 2020 election. Some voters' memories and passions have faded. Many never had strong opinions about their Secretary of State. It all has made the race one of the purest tests yet of whether the 2020 election lie can be weaponized to win elections. While opinion polls have shown that leagues of Republican voters in Georgia and elsewhere largely embraced the fiction that the 2020 election was stolen in its immediate aftermath, it is not clear those concerns alone, or Donald Trump's personal vendetta, are enough to drive voters' choices. I think 2020 was really a turning point in how closely people looked at things, said Sally Grubbs, chairwoman of the Cobb County Republican Party. Before, people might not have even realized that the Secretary of State was in charge of running the elections for the state, but now they're keenly aware of it. Jody Heiss, whom Donald Trump endorsed last year, is one of more than a dozen candidates running for Secretary of State under the America First banner, alongside others in battleground states like Arizona, Michigan, and Ohio. They share an unflinching loyalty to Donald Trump and a belief that the 2020 election was marred. Some are calling for a law enforcement arm to more aggressively prosecute violators of election laws. Opinion polls show large numbers of undecided voters in the race, with Mr. Heiss and Mr. Raffensperger neck and neck, each with about one-third of the vote. Both campaigns are braced for a runoff. Donald Trump's attempt at payback for 2020 in Georgia is floundering in the state's other marquee primary on Tuesday. Former Senator David Perdue, his pick to challenge Governor Brian Kemp after the governor refused to overturn the election results, is trailing Mr. Kemp in opinion polls and fundraising. Donald Trump has hardly weighed in publicly on David Perdue's prospects since hosting a tele-rally for the former senator in April. His former vice president, Mike Pence, is set to visit the state to campaign for Governor Brian Kemp on the eve of the primary election. Mr. Kemp has been adept at using his office to win over skeptical Republicans, passing a slew of conservative policies on elections, law enforcement, and education. For voters still enthralled with false claims of fraud, Governor Brian Kemp can point to the Election Integrity Act of 2021, which limits provisions like ballot drop boxes and mobile voting centers. When voters see that kind of activity around, the concerns they have, it just becomes difficult to drive an argument that people who are in office are being inattentive to the issue, said Brad Alexander, an Atlanta, Georgia-based political consultant and Raffensperger supporter, who was among several who argued that the potency of the stolen election debate has started to wane. In January, 43% of Georgia Republican voters said they were confident that the November elections would be fair and accurate, according to a University of Georgia opinion poll. By April, that number had increased to nearly 60%. And a record number of voters have already participated in the state's primary elections, topping more than 700,000 voters on the final day of early voting. Jody Heiss, a four-term congressman, was one of the 147 House Republicans who voted against certifying the election results for President Joe Biden. He later took part in a White House meeting alongside Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene to try to determine how the election results could be flipped in Donald Trump's favor. He has claimed falsely that Mr. Trump would have won in Georgia if the election had been fair. At a meeting with the Atlanta Young Republicans on Thursday, 19th of May, Jody Heiss made unsupported claims about ballot harvesting, said he no longer wanted to use Dominion voting machines, and slammed Mr. Raffensperger for sending out unsolicited absentee ballots ahead of the last election. The voice of the people had been violated in 2020, he said. County officials in Georgia identified 64 cases of potential fraud out of the state's roughly 5 million votes in the 2020 election, according to an Associated Press survey of all but 11 of the state's 159 counties. But Mr. Heiss has tried to make his case about more than just 2020, raising the prospect of fraud in the future. This issue is not who wins an election, but the issue is absolutely, was it a fair election, he said. If the election itself is compromised or violated, then all the effort out there really doesn't matter anymore. And that's what we've got to defend. That's what we've got to protect at all costs. Most of the young Republicans in the room said they wanted to hear what Jody Heiss would do differently from Brad Raffensperger in elections, should he be elected. Even if you're not a dogmatic election was stolen person, there are a lot of people with reasonable doubt. And that reasonable suspicion is fair, said Chris Campbell, a 39-year-old national accounts manager at SmartFeeds. Raffensperger didn't address those concerns well, and people don't have confidence in him. But I do have confidence in Jody Heiss and trust that he would run the office with integrity. But there were clear divisions over that conclusion. Questions around the 2020 election, like was it stolen or was it not stolen, aren't healthy, said Alan English, the president of the Atlanta Young Republicans, who remained undecided between the candidates. Looking back at 2020 isn't productive, he said. Many Republicans declared Mr. Raffensperger all but defeated as soon as he announced he would run for re-election, citing Donald Trump's ire and that of many voters. Mr. Raffensperger was censured at a state GOP convention last year, but Donald Trump has been unexpectedly quiet about the race beyond lumping Mr. Raffensperger in with Mr. Kemp in statements railing against what he calls the rhinos, or Republicans in name only, running the state. Sarah Longwell, the founder of the Republican Accountability Project, which conducted the focus group last week, said that Donald Trump's limited involvement could be playing a role in some voters' indecision. Mr. Raffensperger has raised more money than his competitors, courting far-right voters and touting what he calls true conservative values. At an event hosted by the Buckhead Young Republicans, Mr. Raffensperger discussed the 2020 election, but said his office was focused on the real issue of preventing non-citizens from voting. Mr. Raffensperger has called for amending the state constitution to prohibit non-citizens from voting, something that state law already forbids. A state review found no instances of ballots being cast by non-citizens in 2020. Mr. Raffensperger acknowledges that his pitch has done little to pacify some Republicans. I was never public enemy number one. I just think that some people weren't pleased with the election results, he said. But in this race here, I'm leaving it to the goodness of my fellow Georgians who stood for the law, made sure that we followed the Constitution and followed the law. And that's all I can do. The roughly 15 people present at the event, mostly 20-something conservatives, were receptive of his message. While some still had concerns about election oversight, they said they appreciated his candor in the face of ongoing attacks. There wasn't anything that anyone else would have done to do anything, said Bradley Schober, a 27-year-old, an attorney who said he had already voted for Mr. Raffensperger. Ultimately, the guy took as much heat as anybody and came out on the other side standing. Despite the high interest in the showdown, less than $1 million has been spent on television advertising in both the Democratic and Republican primary races for Georgia's Secretary of State, according to Ad Impact, an ad advertisement tracking firm which the candidates exchanging attacks over the outcome of the 2020 presidential election and voting integrity. Jody Heiser's adverts have showcased footage of him and Donald Trump at a rally in Georgia, where the former president called Mr. Raffensperger a rhino and one of the worst Secretary of States in America. Mr. Raffensperger's advertisements have tried to rally Republicans against a common opponent, Stacey Abrams, the Democratic nominee for governor. The group she founded, Fair Fight, sued the state over discriminatory election practices in 2018. The lawsuit is currently in court. When Stacey Abrams attacked Georgia's elections, Jody Heiss did nothing, the advertisement's narrator says. The biggest spender on broadcast television has been Bea Nguyen, the leading candidate in the Democratic primary, who has cast herself as a bulwark against Republican efforts to restrict voting access and meddle in the elections. When our voting rights are attacked, Ms. Nguyen says in one advertisement, we all lose.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
Ziyara of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
As-salamu alayka ya Mawlai Musa ibn Ja'far wa rahmatullah.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. And Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was also the seventh divinely appointed imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Now, it is interesting to know that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the testamentary trustee and he was the seventh divinely appointed successor, vice-regent, imam of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam was also the testamentary trustee and the only successor of the sixth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ja'far ibn Muhammad as-Sadiq alayhi salam. It is interesting, but we find in the life of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam that he went through great ordeals, difficulties, trials, tribulations, troublesome afflictions, and it was not limited to these. Matter of fact, Imam al-Qadhim was held hostage in prisons. He was put through pain and torture, and it can be said that he was very much like the Messiah, Isa ibn Maryam, in his devotions, his piety, and his asceticism. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام: لا تمنحوا الجهال الحكمة فتظلموها، ولا تمنعوها أهلها فتظلموهم.
Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam stated, "Do not grant the ignorant ones wisdom, for they will not do justice to it, and do not deprive it to those who are worthy of it, for you will do injustice to them."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. In the very beautiful conversations of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, we find that His Eminence, the seventh divinely appointed Imam, has these conversations with his companions and his friends, and really the people in general, his family members. And in these conversations, there is so very much that we learn. Now, one of the things that we learn in these beautiful conversations of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam is this idea that what is the best kind of alms? You know, we give alms, we give charity in the name of God, in the name of Allah, for the sake of Allah. And here, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam tells us what is the best kind of alms or charity or donation. Of course, all kinds of charity and almsgiving and sadaqah and donation is acceptable in Islam as long as it is being given for the sake of Allah, on the path of Allah, right? So, for example, and then the one who is receiving this donation must also be a recipient who is receiving for the sake of Allah and on the path of Allah. So, for example, instead of giving a donation to, for example, the Red Cross, right, we could give a donation to the Red Crescent. And along these lines, instead of giving a donation, for example, to the poor and the needy and the homeless that are non-Muslims in our community, we can give our alms and our charity to Muslims who are poor and needy in our community. Now, there isn't anything wrong with giving charity to a non-Muslim, but when a Muslim is available, when a Muslim is present, when a Muslim fits all of the requirements and conditions for receiving that donation, of course it makes sense and logical sense that you would prefer and give priority to the Muslim brother before you give to the non-Muslim brother or sister. Now here, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, he says, you're helping the weak people is the best kind of alms. And so according to what we were saying, Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam also is saying the same thing, that the best kind of alms and charity and giving of donation is to help the weak. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now,